Welcome everybody. This is the ninth lecture in the course Perspectives on Bhikkhuni Ordination, done in cooperation between the Women Buddhism Study Initiative and the Momota Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg. Today is the ninth lecture on Tibetans in Burma. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Hiroko Kawanami to give us today's lecture. Hiroko Kawanami did her PhD in anthropology at LSE, University of London. She's at present a senior lecturer in the Department of Politics, Philosophy and Religion at Lancaster University in the UK. She's trained as a social anthropologist and a Buddhist scholar, and has conducted research in Burma for almost 30 years. In 1986, she was initiated by Venerable Ashin Thitila, the author of Essential Themes of Buddhist Lectures in Yangon, and studied under him for 16 months. She has written extensively in English, Japanese, and Burmese about Burmese Buddhist nuns called Tilashin, and her recent monograph is Renunciation and Empowerment of Buddhist Nuns in Yamna, Burma, published by Brilliant Light in 2013. Her recent interests are focused on Buddhism and social justice, application of mindfulness, and the dissemination of monastic education for Buddhist nuns. So this serves for introduction. Now I invite Professor Hiroko Kawanami to give us a talk.
Thank you, Bhikkhu Ananayo, for organizing this wonderful lecture series. And thank you everyone for taking part. I'm sure you are very busy, but for spending an hour and a half with me, this is a great pleasure to have this opportunity. Now, today I will give a comprehensive overview of Burmese Buddhist nuns called Tilashin, and I've roughly divided my talk into seven themes. I do not have to go too much into detail, but can give you a rough idea of how Buddhist nuns in Myanmar live, study, and work, and also to understand their situation within the context of Burma, which has been isolated from the rest of the world since the coup in 1962 until very recently. So let me just go back to the general overview. Now, if you look at this, I think this page in front of you, you would see several terms that I will use. I will use the term Buddhist nuns interchangeably with the word called Tilashin, which is the general term used to describe the Buddhist nuns. Tilashin is actually sila kifer, which is the term for the Buddhist nun in Burma, normally for the eight precept nuns. Now, the majority of Buddhist nuns in Burma are registered with the Department of Religious Affairs. This comes under the religious ministry. And in 2013, there were 50,553 Buddhist nuns officially registered over the age of 12. And these statistics show that Burma has one of the largest concentration of Buddhist nuns after China in the world today. And once registered, a nun carries a mappondin, which is like an ID card, issued only for monastic members. And that means their passport also is in the Buddhist name. They are no longer treated as a lay person as far as their legal status is concerned. Now, Burmese Buddhist nuns can be roughly divided into two types. As you can see there, I have written Parihati, Patipati, Parahita, three terms in Pali. But the first two, Parihati and Patipati, may be used to categorize the nuns in general. The first Parihati, or the nuns who are engaged in Parihati, are those who study and learn and teach. And the next one, Patipati, those who practice Patipati, are those who practice full-time meditation. And although the former pariyatti is the desired occupation, since the study of scriptures gives them an official pathway to become state-accredited Dhamma teachers, in their training, in fact, a balanced pursuit of both theory and practice is generally encouraged. Another type of occupation that has come to the recent attention of the Burmese public is social welfare type of work, referred to as parahita. And traditionally, parahita was regarded more as a sideline occupation, never the main religious work of monks and nuns, since such activities were seen as secular, considered to be the responsibility of lay people and the legal authorities. However, there has been a surge of interest in social volunteering in the last decade. Now, another term you will see on that page, on the right-hand side, one is Ngeyu, and the next one is Togwe. These are Burmese vernacular terms to distinguish another type of, or impose another type of category on monks and nuns. Now, I could say that the age, you know, when we talk about the age, at what age do women become Buddhist nuns in Burma today? I think we have to think about this concept of Ngebu, because the most renowned nunnery schools impose age limits for new entrants, which would be about between 12 and 25, for example. And young candidates are sought after they finish state education at about 12 or 13 years of age. Teachers, non-teachers, tell me that the young children can be trained to adjust to a stringent lifestyle better than adults, because there is a lot of memorization, and it is quite, you know, hard if you are set in your own way already. So in my research, it became evident that the majority of monks and nuns affiliated with prominent monasteries and nunneries in Burma, as well as those members who hold important positions in the Sangha, Mahanayaka, or in the executive committee of nuns, are mostly in the category of Ngebu. The top term, which means young and pure. Actually, these are the virgin nuns and virgin monks. And compared to those who become nuns as adults or in later life, those who enter the monastic vocations early, possibly as children, grow up to become influential members in the monastic community. In contrast, those women who have been divorced and married, and also men also, prior to their entry into the monastic way of life, are referred to as Podue. Podue means one who has left for the forest, but actually this is the term used for adults who became nuns or monks later in life. And few of these nuns, Podue nuns, are affiliated with Buddhist seminaries, where the emphasis is on study, and many end up providing domestic services to monks in monasteries or meditation centers. Now, there are also freestanding nuns called Nedo, and maybe I can show you some photographs here. These are the young Nedo nuns who joined the monastery or nunnery early in their life and spend the rest of their lives as vocational Buddhist nuns. The middle, the other type of nun, which is, they are in the minority, and very few of them are active in the case of this book. But this type of nuns are not officially registered with the Ministry of Religious Affairs, but they seem to appeal to the general public by offering different types of religious service. And these middle nuns tend to be charismatic individuals who attract an audience due to their healing powers or other special skills. Can you hear me? Sorry, maybe you cannot hear me that well. I'll try to speak louder. Now, these middle nuns are famous for their healing powers, sometimes other special skills as well, like clairvoyance, clairaudience, or fortune telling. They do not study like the majority of Buddhist nuns in Burma, but they derive their skill, special skills from the practice of meditation. And all of these middle nuns I came across had been married before, had children, and had encountered a variety of domestic problems prior to their becoming nuns. Their anomalous presence seems to bypass the Sangha authority. That means they do not come under the control of or influence of monks, and they attract not only the deprived segment of society who cannot afford medical treatment, but also the rich and powerful come to them who are keen to enhance their social influence. So they come to us for their fortune, their future, which direction they should take up, and so on. Now, this follower, these two, the couple have come to this meadow. The wife had breast cancer before, but now she has been cured by this meadow, and they came to say thank you to her. Actually, they are Hindus, but they also come to this meadow, none. Of course, there are a few of them, as I said at the beginning, and their presence seems to be tolerated since they are on the fringes of society and do not have a main influence in the monastic community. Let's go back to the general overview here. Now, let me just talk about the number of precepts nuns observe in Burma. The majority of Kailashin observe the 8 precepts, implying that their life is burned by many abstinence practices, such as celibacy and fasting in the afternoon. They also abstain from singing or dancing and do not use any vanity items, such as fragrant cream or mirror. They do not wear wrist watches. So they generally adhere to a way of life characterized by simplicity and self-discipline. However, in contrast to monks, whose daily activities are regulated by the Vinaya, Kailashin can handle cash and engage in monetary transactions in society. And this ability to handle cash, however, can also become an impediment for their moral purity, which they aspire towards, since money is a symbol of pollution and worldly attachment. On the other hand, in many monasteries in Burma, Kailashin act as treasurers and bookkeepers, and this may be different from Thailand, where lay people may take up this role. But in Burma, the relationship between monks and nuns can be very close, and sometimes, well, quite often, you come across these Kailashin being an active administrator in monasteries and working for monks. So they do shopping for the monks, they procure goods for the ceremony, they prepare for the ritual, they do the actual preparation work for many religious functions. And by taking on these seemingly mundane roles, nuns make themselves useful to the monks and also act as a symbolic buffer in protecting the assigned purity of the Sangha. So you have to also understand their symbolic role in bridging the Sangha and society. Now, there are also 10 precept nuns in Burma, and which was discussed by Professor Salgado a few weeks back. And few as they may be, 10 precept nuns are highly respected by the laity for their detachment and moral purity. It's the key word, moral purity. And interestingly, the fact that a 10 precept nun is not apparently in need of cash seems to reverse the normal power relationship observed between a nun and laity, as many lay donors seem to become more intent. People become more keen on supporting a nun if she's a 10 precept. observer. There is one famous Templeset nun called, her name is Donya Neti, who is a Kachin nun from the Kachin ethnic group. But she rose to fame in the mid-1980s due to her academic achievement, discipline, graceful. This means she's also very fair and beautiful. And she now runs a nunnery school in Mijina, which is the capital of the Kachin state, with her sister nun, who observes 8 precepts and acts as her personal assistant. So to become a 10th precept nun, you know, however, is not a realistic option for the majority of Telashin, who do not have personal assistants to whom their daily transactions can be delegated. You need an assistant or a kapya, kalaga, who can deal with the monetary transactions for you. But normally, nuns perform that kind of a supportive role for the monks. Having said that, many 8 precept nuns endeavor to refrain from touching money on a part-time basis. So they try to be a 10 precept observer in the evenings or on special abstinence days so that they can become morally cleansed from time to time. And in this respect, being able to observe their 10 precepts is a huge spiritual leap for many 8 precept nuns. And observing the 10 precepts represents a religious ideal they commonly aspire towards in their spiritual practice. So it is an ideal they try to move on to in their spiritual progression. And the 10 precepts is made more effective by combining it with a few ascetic practices called dutanga, which supports the practitioner to further subjugate her human desires and attachments. And among the 13 types of austerities stipulated in the text, the most common practice in Burma are eating one meal a day, mixing up of the foods, regardless of the kind or taste. You mix the curry and sweets and desserts and everything, and eating food directly from the alms bowl. During such abstinence practice, Buddhist nuns commonly take up strict vegetarianism. They normally are not vegetarians, but on this kind of occasions, they become vegetarian. They give up cooked food. They give up rice consumption, they reduce sleeping hours and meditate for long hours. So the nuns endeavor to adhere to these abstinences in addition to the 10 precepts they observe on special occasions, has to be understood as a stage in their spiritual progression rather than a fixed religious status. Now I see a question about the 9 precepts, which is a very, very important point, because they do not keep 9 precepts. It's either 8 precepts or 10 precepts. But this is quite a complex issue, which I think Professor Salgado also touched upon, that probably in the Nepali nunneries as well, you would notice that if they have been initiated and trained in Burma, the way they take 10 precepts would not be the same as the way 10 precept nuns take them in Sri Lanka. But let me come back to this, because it may take up some time to explain it. So what I have been saying is 10 precept status is a kind of a practice, a higher practice for many 8 precept nuns. And this is something they try to do or aspire towards on a certain sort of abstinence day, and even for a short period. So although the possibility of becoming a bhikkhuni in Burma is close today, becoming a 10 precept nun or practicing the 10 precepts in addition to these many austerities, even for a short time, suggests a spiritual alternative for many Buddhist nuns who strive to enhance the possibility of achieving enlightenment. Now, one more thing I can talk about when we are looking at the types and categories of nuns, I will have to look at the color of their robes. Buddhist nuns show their different occupations through the color of the robes they wear. And this is in stark contrast with monks whose robes are uniformly brown in Burma. The majority of Telashin wear pink upper robes with darker orange color for their lower garment. But there are some who wear reddish brown or dark robes. For instance, this nun, normally they are a practitioner of a certain type of meditation. So there, you can tell that they are not this kind of a scholarly nuns, but they are a serious practitioner of normally samatha meditation. They already mentioned medo that we have seen. She was wearing yellow, but other medos may wear red to distinguish herself from other categories of nuns. But it is rare to see any nuns wearing white in Burma today. During the 18th century, however, it is recorded that a major debate took place regarding the color of nuns' robes in Burma, whether the legitimate color should be white or reddish brown, but not pink. The majority of Burmese nuns then were in fact clad in white, and you also noticed that in old photographs that they were maybe in the 18th century they were still wearing white, which is in keeping with the tradition of female renunciants in other Buddhist countries in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. Now, it is recorded that a senior monk who was the head of Chuejin sect, which is one of the stricter, more rigid Buddhist sect in Burma, and around the turn of the 20th century, he advised local nuns to wear colored robes in order to distinguish themselves from laywomen who wore white when taking their abstinence vows. So when I interviewed elderly nuns in the area, have told me, and some of them still do this, which is they dye white cloth, white cotton cloth, to various shade of ochre using the local red soil, which is a natural dye in the local community. Nowadays they use chemical dye. Or the younger nuns may just use the dyed imported textile from China or India. But this kind of a practice to dye white cloth into various shade of ochre has become the norm. And from that local community in the Salayan Hills, the practice spread to other parts of the country. And now it has become the norm for Burmese Telashin to wear pink for the upper robes and darker red for the lower garment. Okay. Now I want to move on to the next section, which is about why do women renounce? Why do people become nuns? To start with. Now there is a very well-known Burmese proverb which I have quoted on several occasions, so you might already know this. But the proverb goes, Buddhist nuns are women whose sons are dead, who are widowed, bankrupt, in debt, and broken-hearted. This kind of negative social narrative perpetuates the image of fallen, poor, or broken women who have no other option but to become a Buddhist nun. Now, when I first embarked on my fieldwork in the mid-1980s, with little prior knowledge about Buddhist nuns, some of my Yangon middle-class intellectuals have told me about this proverb. And I tried to look for such women who have had negative reasons to become a nun, and could find very few who fitted the stereotype. What many bystanders underestimate or forget is the power of faith that motivates many Buddhist women to go against the notion of good womanhood and give up what is expected of them in society. You may also recall that a few weeks ago, Professor Nirmala Salgado has emphasized the importance of religious reasons in understanding why Buddhist women renounce. Contrary to the already mentioned proverb, many nuns I interviewed told me about their strong conviction in making their decision to become a nun. In fact, none of them I interviewed had been forced or coerced to become nuns, and had made the decision after much soul-searching and often against the wishes of their families and relatives, and many of them had been met with fierce family opposition. One nun said her mother cried for days, and her father threatened to take the abbess to court should she accept his daughter into the nunnery. I remember my teacher saying that her family, her mother and brothers were so angry that they came to the nunnery and took away everything that she brought with her, even up to the family photographs, to lure her back to the family. But she had made a very strong decision. It was also another nun told me that her brother said that it was so shameful to be called a brother of a Tashi. So nonetheless, many women who become nuns express a strong feeling of having wanted to break free from the many constraints of a traditional patriarchal society where women's options and rights were limited, especially in rural communities. However, the younger generation of nuns nowadays seems to view renunciation as a practical means to become educated, to become independent, and subsequently become established in a religious vocation. The majority of Buddhist nuns in Burma come from rural agricultural communities, traditionally known for their piety and generosity. Interviews conducted during my fieldwork showed that almost 85% of those studying or teaching in nunnery schools were from rural villages or semi-rural towns where their families were engaged in farming or agricultural trade. In contrast, those from large cities such as Yangon or Mandalay were the minority. If you remember, the already mentioned negative portrayal of Buddhist nuns as women who have left home to escape poverty and associated drudgery did not correspond with their background information at all. Many came from a relatively affluent agricultural background, and three-quarters were from families with large landholdings or assets that allowed them to have a non-productive and dependent member in the family so that they could support their daughters until they become established as teachers. Of course, I have to mention that high food and commodity prices, especially during the last few decades, have put much pressure on ordinary people's lives. And many of my informants have voiced their struggle to make ends meet. It is not easy to look after, to survive if you have many children and so on. And women who are often the main breadwinners in Burma have to juggle their many roles as mothers, wives, and even laborers to support their families. But I have to emphasize that it is not poverty per se that motivates a woman to take drastic measures to renounce life altogether. There are other social factors. For example, when a child loses the mother, it obviously has a profound effect. If the mother dies or remarries in Burma, and if the child is a girl, she is normally sent to live with a female relative. Or if she is already an adolescent, relatives may force her to marry. In many cases, my non-informants listed the loss of their mother or the arrival of a stepmother, so either through illness, divorce, or abandonment, so that the mother, they've lost the mother, as one of their main reasons for becoming a nun. But then the trauma that gave her the initial motive to leave home may gradually become replaced by a deep religious conviction that grows in the monastic life. Now, these two lovely nuns. I think the younger one is 9 years old. Her sister is 11. They have one more sister who's 13. They all have become nuns because their mother actually abandoned them, left them for another man, and the father could not cope as he had to work full time. And initially they lived with their mother's mother, the grandmother, but the grandmother also couldn't afford to look after three teenagers, and the father eventually brought them to the nunnery. Here you see them with this little female dog, with a little bitch. They have just saved this dog as her leg was broken. And as you know, in Burma, people do not kill animals if they are Buddhists, but they do not want a female or dog to be hanging around or even in the neighborhood, because they would have puppies, they would have more children, and it would put a strain on the economy. So normally they throw stones at female dogs to get rid of them, although they may keep the male dog. But these little girls probably somehow sympathize with this little female dog somehow and decide to save her. So now, one more thing I want to mention in regard to this motive, why do women or girls become nuns? In connection to this, Professor Salgado also mentioned the recent publication of Shane Clark's book, a very important book, which I also have, I think, Family Matters in Indian Buddhist Monasticism. It is relevant to understand family connections in this discussion we are having. For example, today, if one meets a young nun under the age of 10, let's say, one can be certain that she has a close female kin, an aunt, grandmother, or a mother, cousin, or someone who is a nun, or in some cases a male relative who is a monk in the monastic community. This phenomenon of children joining their monastic relatives seem to have become more common in Burma since the government introduced a system of compulsory registration in the mid-1980s, which requires a stringent policy of entry qualifications for those wishing to become vocational members in the monastic community. So the application procedure, which requires many letters of recommendation from senior monks and nuns, seems to have made it more difficult to join for girls without any contacts within. And ironically, it made it much easier for those who have family connections already in the monastic community. And in this respect, kin connection is another factor we have to look into in order to understand their motives, why young children renounce. Okay, now I have to move on to the next section, which is about initiation. After why, this is about how. How do women become Buddhist nuns? And it may be an interesting comparison if you compare it with the ordination procedure, because even though Buddhist nuns in Myanmar are not ordained bhikkhuni, they still have an initiation ritual and a procedure that officially accepts them into the monastic community. Stories narrated by elderly nuns I interviewed said that in the early part of the 20th century, becoming a Buddhist nun in Burma used to be a very simple and private affair. The procedure consisted only of shaving off the hair, taking the 8 precepts, and answering standard questions posed by the abbess of the host nunnery. The female candidate then changed into a nun's robe, and that was sufficient to acknowledge her status change. Today, a potential female candidate has to undergo a lengthy interview process for senior nuns of the host institution. She is asked many questions aimed to evaluate the genuine quality of her motivation before she is accepted on condition that she undergoes probation. Some of the questions appear remarkably similar to what might have been asked if she was becoming a bhikkhu. However, the content in which they are put to her is not the same in initiation ceremony. Let's see, some of the questions are, for example, will you stay for life or only for a temporary period? Which do you intend to engage in, Pariyatti or Patipati? Will you obey the rules and regulations of the nunnery school? Do you have any problems that may have caused you to renounce? So they are asked many questions. The potential candidate is asked if she is free, if she is free of any other ties, and whether there are any hidden reasons for her wanting to become a nun. The senior nun who interrogates tries to explore whether the candidate has a criminal record, any debts, a lover, family problems, or any undisclosed illnesses. A question about financial support is also put to her. For example, is your family willing to support you, or do you have a material benefactor or some kind of a funding to sustain her as a Buddhist nun? What senior nuns are interested in is the general aptitude and the true intention of the candidate. They look for particular qualities that exhibit honesty, a calm temperament, general obedience. If the panel is roundly satisfied, the candidate is accepted informally and undergoes a designated trial period during which she is required to observe the 8 precepts, including fasting in the afternoon and celibacy, and is encouraged to help with the chores in the nunnery. Now, the length of probation nowadays has become much shorter, maybe about a month. However, in the past, a female novice was tested for a longer period. I was told by these elderly nuns in their 80s, or in their 90s, that some of them spent 2 years during which they were tested. So 2 years is the same as the doctrinally stipulated length of probation. A newcomer is initially accepted as a yogi. This is a status for a practitioner who practices 8 precepts in the late stages and is supervised closely by senior nuns such as the abbess, her preceptor, and guarantor, who all act in their different roles to look after her. Now, I also have this experience of staying as a yogi while I was tested to enter the nunnery. The clothes I wore was a white blouse and a brown lower garment, and I had my hair, but had to keep it very short and was not allowed to wear any adornments or makeup, and had to refrain from going out or visiting friends for the duration of probation. And I think this applies to all probationers. She has to familiarize herself with the monastic discipline, such as getting up at 4:30 in the morning and not eating in the afternoon, and engage with many of the allocated tasks, and work with other nuns. Her aptitude for obedience and diligence are continually assessed. If she is hot-tempered, lazy, or inclined to gossip, she is asked to leave at an early stage. Intelligence is another quality that senior nuns look for in a candidate, and an increasing number of young girls are accepted primarily for their potential to make good students. Most importantly, an innate disposition, a personality, that allows her to live in harmony with others in a communal environment is seen as an essential quality that marks her out as a good candidate. But however young, she is ultimately expected to make up her own mind about whether or not she wants to become trained as a vocational member. Now, the initiation ceremony itself is called Tilashin Bukhe in English language, which means a ceremony to don the nun's robe. This is what the initiation is called. There are no specific rules concerning the actual initiation, but the ceremony is required by both the candidate and the nun's community to mark her status transition to a Buddhist. In recent decades, the ceremonial procedure has become increasingly lavished and conducted in private. Conducted in public, which is a change from a private ceremony, which used to be conducted almost in secret. And this is possibly as a result of an increasing number of young women taking up temporary initiation in Burma. The ceremony has also become much more structured in accepting a female candidate into the monastic community. In the past, nuns were in sole charge of the ritual, and the presence of a monk was not regarded necessary. Besides, it was normally conducted in secret to avoid any fears of opposition from the candidate's family. However, the increasingly public nature of initiation has created new demands for the ceremony to be authenticated by the Sangha, and nowadays a nun's initiation is conducted in the presence of an average of 3 to 5 monks who participate to endorse its legitimacy. The actual ritual is divided into 2 parts. The theme of the first part is renunciation of the world, and the second part focuses on her integration into the nun's community. There is almost a theatrical element involved in the ritual. The female initiate, sometimes several of them, arrives dressed in a bright, colorful garment of a princess. There are two different photographs here combined as one. As you can see, the row, the princess attire is very colorful, and they have this a crown in the shape of a mythical bird, which seems to be the popular garment they wear. And as the cutting starts, the participant nuns collectively recite the stanza of mindfulness on the 32 parts of the body. This is the kind of a stanza used or recited in every initiation ceremony. The recitation is in the Pali language, listing the 32 parts of the body, reminding every participant that nothing of a person is essential, since everyone is reduced to this bodily component. So it starts with hair, kesa, and 32 parts are recited, all the way, tendons, bones, bone marrow, kidney, heart, liver, and so on, until urine, mutang, is the last one. It is repeatedly recited in a loop by the nuns who are attending to make the ceremony happen. The message here is one of resignation to the transient nature of the body and an acceptance of the natural processes that governs it. The recitation continues. There is no self, no substance, there is no male and no female. This is all recited in Pali language and continues in, as I said, in a recitation loop. No one can escape the cycle of aging, illness, and death, and so on. Parents and relatives are called upon to join the nuns in their slow and repetitive recitation. During the ceremony, the initiate, as well as close family members, often burst into tears at the moment of haircutting. While the hair is being cut and then shaved, this recitation keeps going on and on. And one could say that she has discarded everything symbolic. She is reminded of that, associated with the notion of womanhood: hair, beauty, sexuality, pride, maternity, she will never have children, and other implications of her female gender is constantly reminded. For the would-be nun, the thing up of the hair may be the first test of her movement, and once the initiate's hair is, head is completely shaved, the collective chanting also stops. The procedure then obliges her to solicit the officiating nun to hand over a set of a nun's robes, and marking the climax of the first part of the ceremony. Now, the second half of the ceremony begins with a solemn entry of the female initiate. Outwardly, she's transformed into a Buddhist nun. And this part is conducted by a principal monk who arrives at this point in time. The monk guides the congregation through the standard formula that glorifies the Buddha's virtuous qualities, after which the main mantra of taking refuge in the three jewels is collectively recited. Uposatha Tila, the taking of precepts, follows. And since the vows in this case are for the newly initiated nun, 8 precepts are recited instead of the usual 5 precepts for the laity. And then the monk may preach on a special topic that concerns the newly initiated, such as the moral education, so on. It depends on what the monk would like to preach. Then, towards the end, he is asked to confer a Buddhist title, a Buddhist name in Pali language. One syllable is taken from the day of the week on which she was born, and this becomes her official name for as long as she remains a nun. The religious significance of an initiation ritual lies in the first half of the ceremony, when the female candidate is psychologically prepared to go through the drastic exterior transition from a glamorous princess adorned in beautiful clothes to a plain-clothes, shaven mendicant who has left behind her worldly possessions. The cutting off of her hair is an emotional catalyst that often causes an initiate to become visibly shaken. As her feminine attributes are cast away, the transition is said to touch something deep within, allowing the initiate to overcome her vanity and give away material attachment. And much emphasis is made upon the contrast between the impermanent nature of one's physical existence and the moral virtues of monastic life. And this seems to help the novice see the meritorious value of her decision to become a Buddhist nun and appreciate her new position in a spiritual light. Now, in the second half of the ceremony, which is a relatively recent addition to the ritual, the religious status of the initiate is sanctioned by an officiating monk, and she is formally accepted into the nun's community. Okay. Now, let me go to put the nuns in a wider context and look at the relationship with the state. And I need to talk a little about the political situation of Burma in the international community here and how this has affected the Buddhist monastic community and especially the nuns. So quickly, I would just mention that in the early 1990s, the previous military government, Burma has recently opened up after the general election in 2010, and reform has started in 2011. So the situation is changing very quickly, but still, the previous military government has left a mark. And in the early 1990s, they appropriated Buddhism, and because they saw it as an effective moral tool to engage with the hostile international community. And perhaps it was originally led by the political imperative of the government. Buddhist monks and nuns in Burma became co-opted into the state policy to missionize. And as part of the state initiative, Theravada Buddhist Missionary University was opened in December 1998 in Yangon to train both monks and nuns as Buddhist missionaries who could spread the Dhamma abroad. Now young scholarly inclined nuns, they were previously barred from the state Sangha universities, were encouraged to enter the new missionary university where subjects such as comparative religion and foreign languages are taught in the English language medium in addition to traditional Buddhist scriptural studies. Therefore, the policy to train and send out Buddhist missionaries to the international community has resulted in English-speaking scholarly nuns in Burma becoming accepted as an important contingent of the Buddhist monastic community, and strangely but subsequently started to close the gender disparity between monks and nuns, especially among educated monastic members. Currently, Chilashin Buddhist nuns in Burma are represented at the regional and township tiers of the state monastic organizations. And in 2013, these Chilashin councils at the regional levels were operating in 8 regions, as well as in the capital Naypyidaw, and in 4 ethnic self-governed zones, which is in the Mon, Shan, Kachin, and Karen states. Now, Chilashin councils at the township level, this is one tier below the regional level, but at the township level are the most active concerning day-to-day communal affairs. And their representatives, including the elected Chilashin president and secretary of the township, are required to meet every 6 months to discuss whatever issues concern the local resident nuns. These issues, the issues they discuss may range from those that concern the local environment to practical problems related to the running of nunneries, as well as dealing with nuns who have transgressed the monastic code of conduct. The Sangha decree stipulates, actually, there is a Sangha decree saying that each township that has a minimum of 4 nunnery schools should form a township council for nuns. And although any vocational nuns can influence the decision-making process, only abbesses who represent independent nunnery schools are eligible to be nominated for elections and then become elected members of the township Chilashin Council. And in this respect, although the original attempt to form a national council for all Buddhist nuns in Burma was meant to co-opt both types of nuns, meditating nuns living in monasteries or meditation centers, and scholarly nuns in nunnery schools, it was the latter type of educated nuns who were given the official channel to voice their opinions and enhance their regional influence in the township tier of the monastic education, of the monastic organizations. And here you realize how important it is to be affiliated with nunnery school is, and how important it is to become educated, because that gives them an official channel to voice their opinion and become part of the decision-making process. And today, nun teachers and abbesses representing large nunnery schools exercise considerable authority in the local community by granting permission to new entrants, overseeing nunnery affairs, penalizing or sometimes even defrocking so-called troublemakers, and taking overall responsibility for the welfare of non-residents in the townships. These nuns are also responsible for making students and junior nuns comply with the national nuns' code of practice called Chilashin Chinwood, endorsed by the Sangha Mahanayaka, which provides an ethical guideline as well as prescribing monastic duties and obligations for all Chilashins in Burma. Now, one thing I have noticed in recent years is a large increase in the number of independents in ethnic self-administered zones, so in the ethnic state. In total, there are currently 543 independent nunneries in Karen and Kaya states in the east, Mon in the southeast, Chin in the west, Kachin and Shan states bordering China to the north, and Rakhine state in the south. So more than 500 nunneries, independent nunneries, have been established in these definite states. For example, when I first arrived at Donya Nyasari Sakundai, which is the largest nunnery school in Yangon in the mid-1980s, I counted about 6 ethnic nuns among 400 listed nuns. And 30 years later, I went and counted again, and more than a quarter of its nun students, and more than about 120, were from these ethnic self-administered zones. Now, ethnic nuns who graduated from this nunnery school alone have established 42 independent nunnery schools in the last 20 years. And these figures may give some indication of the contribution being made by Buddhist nuns in the acculturation policy of the Burmese state, although perhaps unwittingly, since most of them have remained largely apolitical and indifferent to the political motives of the government. But they have been, even compared to monks who are political and can be a problem sometimes, nuns who are seen as apolitical have made a contribution in converting many of these ethnic populations who are Christians or Buddhists, or they are not necessarily Buddhists, to Buddhism in the last maybe 20-some years. Now, let me see how much time I have. Well, I can say that the nuns have also been very much engaged in many welfare projects. And, for example, the Buddhist Home for the Aged, the country's first all-people's home, was established in Yingun by Nun Uzun in 1915. And since then, she went on to open 5 more all-people's homes in various parts of the country and accommodated infirm men and women who have no kin relations to look after them. So although the majority of social welfare type of work may be instigated by Buddhist nuns, there are nuns who are engaged in this type of work. However, in the case of Do Uzon, she was a wealthy laywoman to start with, who donated her assets and property to these homes and later in life became a nun. So her welfare work may not be typical, since the majority of nuns do not have the means to invest in such a major undertaking. Well, I ask this, but many Buddhist nuns in Burma are normally reluctant to take up social welfare type of work as a full-time occupation, probably due to the prevailing perception that views Parashita to be a poor diversion from their proper religious work. And it is also difficult to get material support from society. If it was a Buddhist seminary, it would be much easier to get lay support. But if it is an orphanage, I think people would be a little bit wary, thinking, why is she not doing the study and teaching and so on. Many lay donors I spoke to also held the view that monastic members should not involve themselves with worldly affairs or worldly matters, wasting their time in government offices and dealing with corrupt officials, since such experience could only undermine their other worldly moral qualities. However, there has been a noticeable shift following the Asian tsunami in 2004, and more specifically since Cyclone Nargis in 2008, which seems to have been catalyst in triggering a change in people's perceptions towards social donations. Walton and Jacket has written an article recently describing the changing donation practices after Cyclone Nargis in Burma as a result of prominent monks such as the Citta Guru Seado, working as a social media to channel people's goodwill to those who are actually suffering, to victims of disasters. Buddhist nuns were also active during that time, looking after the finances and organizing relief operations in whatever supporting roles and areas in which they were required, but they were less visible in the public domain during disaster relief, and thus their contribution in helping victims was not as appreciated as that of monks. This lack of visibility despite their actual involvement may be one of the issues that needs to be addressed if Buddhist nuns are going to make a further contribution to society and social work. Socially engaged nuns are already playing important roles in politically sensitive regions, as I have already touched upon. Now, social engagement continues to present a dilemma for Buddhist nuns who are on the threshold between this worldly sort of engagement and the otherworldly religious work. Since if they become too closely identified with mundane affairs, they might lose the level of respect they require to position themselves as otherworldly monastic members alongside monks to receive material support and respect from the laity. And yet their services of care are very much in demand by many sectors of society, and this is a dilemma that continues to be unresolved for the nuns. Now, for the last section, which is a big section, and with this section I will try to foresee the direction in which the Burmese nuns may take themselves in the future. And it is very important because it is a section about their community. Because here you have to remember what Bhikkhu Nidhamananda said last week, that it is not about the individual, it is not about one's individual achievement or empowerment, but it is about the community, and it is important to move forward together, not only as a lone bhikkhuni. And for the Burmese nuns community, the sense of unity has been very strong. And for the unity to cohes, to hold this unity, education has been the key. And for the last century, the fostering of scriptural knowledge has been one of the primary goals for Buddhist nuns in Burma. And they encountered much hardship. Their predecessors, early pioneer nuns, have encountered much hardship, which has been documented in several of my articles. Their efforts have culminated in a large number of independent members. There is also a widening network, social network of non-teachers and students today. In fact, in 2013, the latest statistics show that there were 3,881 independent Buddhist nunneries in Burma. This is the registered Buddhist nunneries nationwide, and more than 600 Buddhist nuns have passed the scriptural exams and become qualified as state accredited Dhammacharya. A Dhamma teacher, you are qualified to teach the Dhamma. And once you become a Dhammacharya, you are given a state seal, which is the official seal of authority that you stand at the end of every letter. You are also given various privileges, which gives you special status in Burmese society. The national Buddhist curriculum drawn up by the Department of Religious Affairs currently allows Tilashins to study Pali scriptures, including the Vinaya, and they can sit the state scriptural exams called Tathamabhyan up to the fifth level alongside monks and acquire official Buddhist degrees. There are also exams conducted by private Buddhist organizations that are open to nuns, which award them with various degrees that certify different levels of spiritual knowledge. And interestingly, it is the state-administered Kokamabhyan exam, scriptural exams, that have given Tilashins a tangible channel to enhance their educational standards, raise their academic profile, and foster quality teachers. One of the lectures. Teacher called Makusalawati is one of the most respected. She's very young, only 42 years old, but highly respected Abhidhamma teacher. She's also very good at Pali. And one thing I have to say that when her monk teacher, a very famous scholar in Yangon, was arrested during the uprising in 1988 onto 1990, he was arrested several times simply because he was the teacher of a very big monastery, Buddhist monastery, a seminary, and he had about 4,000 monk students under his influence. So the authorities were very worried about him pushing the monks out to the streets to demonstrate. So her teacher called Incensiado Ututira was in jail. And at that time, she was only about 23, and she had to teach all his monk students because she was so bright, this young nun student, in place of her teacher, had to give lessons to all the monk students. The knowledge is power, and once you get to that stage, it is no longer the gender that matters, but your ability to teach and your knowledge of the Pali canon. These are all the nuns sitting for, I think this was a mock exam conducted in the nunnery school. They work very hard. The high educational of Buddhist nuns witnessed in their success in the Patamabhyan exams have also contributed to the rising social stature of scholar nuns. The positive changes in public perception towards these nuns can be discerned in the popularity of temporary initiations for girls among young or middle-class families. They send their daughters to reputable nunneries during school holidays so that they can learn about Buddhist ethics and practice discipline. Stories of non-scholars are circulated in Buddhist magazine and in the social media, like the Facebook. You constantly hear about these amazing non-scholars. And sometimes these nunnery schools are introduced on local TV programs. But it seems to me that academic qualifications in Buddhist studies have given them the most tangible determinants in uplifting their social religious position. And education has also given them the confidence to speak out in public about their situations and future prospects. And for the scholarly inclined nuns, they have become part of the state organization, as we have already seen, to make an impact. You see that in this nunnery school, the discipline is very much part of their training, and you see how they use their handle, and mindfulness is taught in every aspect of their conduct. Now, in this, they may not have the bhikkhuni lineage, they may not have the ordination lineage, but they do have the scholastic lineage. And Burmese nuns are affiliated with this scholastic lineage gives them a sense of belonging, as well as a sense of continuity and an identity as a strong sort of a united community. And it is in the teacher and disciple lineage that Tilashis learn about how to recite and chant, or how to behave properly as a nun, and how to observe the code of conduct. So in this community, in their everyday life, from senior nuns to junior nuns, from teacher to students, this is how they become initiated and trained and become a proper vocational member. So we have to look at the importance of their community. Now, Sagaing Hill, this is where I conducted fieldwork for a long time, in particular has occupied a central place in the monastic education for Burmese Buddhist nuns since the first recorded nunnery school of Nam Mik Kim was established in the 19th century. I am sure that there must have been other nunnery schools before that, but this is the first recorded nunnery school that we can read in the history of Burmese Buddhism. Maybe this is because she was patronized by the Buddhist king Mindon, and many of the king's disciples were also patronized by the next king, the last king, people. One thing I have to say is that this lineage that originates from Sagaing has spread to other parts of the country, actually all over the country. And Dorpin Nyasari, who was the founder nun of Kimera Majaung in Molemiri, was also affiliated with this scholastic lineage. And she went to study in Ningun and Sagaing. And after completing her studies, she returned to Molemien to start her own nunnery school. And it was at her school that the Nepali nun, Do Damawati, was initiated and studied for many years before qualifying as a state-accredited Dhammacharya and then taking the lineage back to Nepal. So Do Damawati is also affiliated with the scholastic lineage that you can trace back to the 19th century. One more thing when we talk about community of nuns, I have to talk about the partnership nuns have with their friends or colleagues. And this is essential for their vocational life. And we have to think about how nuns help each other in order to become accomplished or in order to become educated. You know, there is a various kinds of mutual help. So again, you cannot do it on your own, but you have to help each other, and they have done precisely that. All these things on the picture have this one. Yes, but the ninth precept is not exactly a precept. It is about the sending out of metta. This is, it doesn't prohibit you from doing that. The ninth is the connecting precept between the eighth and the tenth, which gives you a way to send out metta. Now, for student nuns, life in a nunnery school is a pressured existence, where their everyday life is governed by a collective goal to study the scriptures and progress towards passing the annual state exam. So there is a lot of pressure. Moreover, domestic chores are laborious and never-ending, since Burmese nunneries do not have any labor-saving devices or modern convening that we take for granted in our everyday lives. Maybe monasteries may have these modicons, but in most nunneries they do not have these modern convenience. So it can take up a whole morning cooking a meal over a stove, and then even more time is spent on cleaning the soup covered pots. In addition, visitors come at all times of the day, and nuns also have to prepare and attend the rituals and religious functions. They're very busy. And to ease the pressures of both work and study, nuns form close partnerships with friends and colleagues to help each other and spread the load. Now, a partnership between nuns is usually established between friends, but most commonly with someone they have grown up with in the nunnery. And long-lasting partnerships seem to rest on a mixture of resources, such as the talents and skills of those nuns involved, and these are supported normally by their complementarity. One nun may be more patient, while her partner may be the talkative one. It can be a personality thing. Sometimes it is the talent and skills. For example, should a nun be outstanding in her academic ability, her partner friend tends to step in to manage the domestic side of the household. Like she might be doing the cooking and looking after the lay visitors, or she might be doing the social side of which is very important if you are also a nun. Young students in particular do not have assistants, so they help one another by negotiating their time and dividing responsibilities and chores. Nuns also require long-term financial support until they become established, and a partner who has material backing is indispensable if a nun herself does not have any means. So a typical partnership is that between a nun who is academically gifted and her friend who has solid financial backing in terms of wealthy family or sponsors. She might have inherited something to help her friend. And in many successful cases, there is an overlap. The nun with wealthy relatives may also be a good manager so that her partner, in this case a scholarly nun, can concentrate on the demanding scriptural studies. On becoming established as teachers, they continue to maintain their partnership and negotiate the division of labor to ease the pressure of teaching and work. So they do it as a unit, they do it as a partnership. But it is very rare to see a nun on her own, simply because the pressure is such that it is almost impossible to become accomplished if you are alone in this community. And in the case of an abbess, it is most crucial to team up with a competent partner who can fulfill the managerial role. If you remember the example I gave earlier on, this Kachin nun, who is a 10-precept observer, she teamed up with her sister, who is an 8-precept observer, so she can handle money. And that was a partnership between sisters, but often it is a partnership between friends. And if it is an abbess, she would definitely need a competent partner. Because the abbess often tends to be an honorary role who is there to welcome the visitors and to give a speech and so on. But you need a competent managerial partner who does the actual running of a nunnery. Between them, they take charge of running a nunnery school as well as administering their private household. Normally, it is the partner of the abbess who is behind the scene, but who is the most influential person. And if the principal herself is not qualified to teach, then teaching is very important, the qualifications, ability to teach is important, but if she is not a qualified teacher, she has to find a partner who has the essential academic credentials, which are increasingly relevant in running a nunnery school. Now, one more area that I want to add is about the land ownership, because this was touched upon by Professor Nirmala Sagado from Sri Lanka. And there is a difference between nunneries in Sri Lanka and nunneries in Burma on this point. As I said earlier, there are more than 3,800 independent nunneries in Burma State, and these are privately owned, usually legally by the abbess of the nunnery. This is in terms of the deeds. You would see that it is in the name of the abbess. And one of the unique features of Burmese nunneries is this strong emphasis on the private landholding. And this is distinct from monasteries, which are commonly owned by the Sangha, and where the common heritage of monks is protected by the stipulations in the Vinaya. The situation, as I said, appears to be different in Sri Lanka. Professor Salgado has pointed out that the nuns there do not seem to enjoy land ownership. In Burma, by contrast, nuns aspire to become independent so that they can own their own nunneries, they can start their own nunnery schools. And nunneries and nunnery schools have been traditionally independently owned by and run by nuns. So, this is in the case of independent nunneries, but there are also nuns affiliated and live in monasteries which are run by monks. But in those cases, as I said in the beginning, they are not the scholarly or educated nuns in the pariyati category. They tend to be the meditating nuns by default, but often frequently they tend to be relatives of the monks who administer that monastery. Now, having said that, even though most nunneries are independently run in Burma, once established, a nunnery as an institution undergoes a process which Strensky, in his 1983 article, referred to as domestication. This is a process which implies a gradual, you can say, process that corrodes the communal foundation of the nunnery and disrupts the line of scholarly transmission. What happens is the family and kin of the abbess home starts to interfere, and this makes nuns more susceptible to the secular interests of their own family and kin, and which manifests especially at the time of succession from one abbess to the next. And basically they interfere how to pass on the property of the nunnery to the next generation, and this becomes a contentious issue. But I suppose I don't have much time to go into this. I have one chapter on this in my book published in 2013, if you want to have more details about it. Now, let me just turn to some of the questions. Maneri Damadina. The ninth precept, Nyeta Saha Gatana, Sikana Sabapana, Utusi. I undertook the role of training to stay in the chapter of self-control. All living creatures. Thank you for this. The ninth precept they normally refer to as the ninth precept is really to give out the metta to all living creatures. And I did discuss this in my early 1990 article, but interestingly, the eighth precept normally it could have split into the eighth and ninth, but it's squashed into eight as one long precept, and the ninth precept is this kind of a sending out of the loving kindness, mind tranquil, mind infuses volition of love into all living creatures, has become the way in which nuns recite the taking of the Ten Precepts has become different from the way they take Ten Precepts in Sri Lanka, or even the way male novices take Eight Precepts are different from the peculiar way in which Myanmar nuns take Nine Precepts. The nuns here in this photograph from Sabine are actually Eight Precept observers. They are all students, and the rules are that while they are studying, they have to be Eight Precept observers. Now, again, the way they wear their gaunti, the shoulder shawl on their left hand shoulder, shows that although they belong to this lineage originally from Sabine, they are from this sub-branch from Yangon, so we call them Yangon nuns, because they wear their shawl in a different manner from the Sabine nuns. Tiny details will show that they belong to the sub-branch or sub-sub-branch of this original lineage. Now, this is about the community. Now, you might think that this is an older nun teaching the younger nun, but actually they are all in the same class. So, you know that in the monastic hierarchy, it is not a biological age, but it is when you entered the monastic community that decides your position in the monastic hierarchy. Actually, they are at the same stage in their scholarly knowledge. So, actually, sometimes this elder nun is asking the younger nun about study. It looks like the other way around. But they do help each other when they study and when they work and so on. This is Dosarana, my teacher, who is now deceased, but the monastic hierarchy is very clear, and the students are totally loyal to their students. Of course, the teacher has huge responsibility to look after their progress and development. Some of them are very young, so they also take on pastoral roles. And the bond between the teacher and student is very, very strong and close, and often you see without being forced, the students really washing the clothes of the teacher, wanting to help the teacher, wanting to do something for the teacher without even being prompted. So if they don't get on with the teacher, the rule is once you lose your mentor or preceptor, you will have to start from the beginning, from the bottom of the pecking order, because you have to find a teacher. And that puts you at the lower ranks all over again, in a way to be able to maintain this good relationship with the preceptor is very, very important. Sometimes your Dhamma teacher is not necessarily a preceptor. Sometimes there is an overlap, other times there isn't. Sometimes your teacher is not necessarily a nun. Sometimes you have several teachers, sometimes your teacher is a monk. So, there are various situations. Now, are there any questions? I think I've spoken quite enough. Writing. maybe one or last point is since we have started with the Bhikkhuni Vinaya and talking about the Bhikkhuni ordination in this lecture series, for those who are not familiar with situation in Burma, is that Kailashins in Burma are not ordained deacons. As I said, most of them are eight precept observers, although there is a national Kailashins code of conduct that they have to observe, and so on. So they are not bhikkhuni, but they themselves seem to found an alternative way of empowering themselves through education or enhancing their influence through becoming more vocal in the state monastic organizations. And the Burmese Sangha, as well as the nuns themselves, seem to accept the position that bhikkhunis cannot be reinstated in Burma according to the Theravada doctrinal tradition. Probably you already know that in 2003, a Burmese Kailashin called Sachawadi, her Burmese name is Matisawadi, she went to Sri Lanka and became ordained as a bhikkhuni. And following the event, a committee of senior monks was appointed by the Sangha Mahanayaka to examine the validity of a revived bhikkhuni ordination in the Theravada tradition. So there was a period when the monks, some of the monks did research on this issue, and this resulted in the publication of Bhikkhuni Niseya Satan, which was published by the Department of Religious Affairs, and I have written about this. And the conclusion of this publication clarified the Sangha's official view that bhikkhunis cannot be reinstated in the Theravada tradition. And this brought a close to the debate in Burma, at least for the foreseeable future. Now, there are bhikkhunis like Domorini, who is residing in Yangon, probably about 6 months of the year. Now, it does not really matter, it seems. The Sangha doesn't cause any problem. As long as they keep it quiet, she still wears her brown robes, and as long as she does not become antagonistic or she becomes provocative in inciting the public opinion. But as long as she lives quietly as a bhikkhuni, I think the Sangha does not seem to does not seem to think of this as a problem today. The majority of Kailashin I spoke to seemed either indifferent, because they already have some influence in society, and many of them were actually unfamiliar with the ongoing debate in the international Buddhist community about reviving the bhikkhuni lineage. Some of them knew Sachawadi personally, or had studied with them earlier, or had heard about her case. So some of them, I would say few, maybe about five nuns have known her prior to her becoming a bhikkhuni. But many of these nuns were quite critical of her confrontational attitude toward the Sangha, and that was the start of the problem, that she wrote a very confrontational letter to the Sangha, addressed to the Sangha, denouncing their attitude toward the bhikkhuni revival. And Burmese Kailashin usually defer to the monks on important issues, and also are trained to adhere to the traditional notions of duty and communal cohesion. So it is difficult for them to fight for a more progressive direction in closing the gender disparity gap. And as I said, within the present context, they are already achieving what they want, and they have a support for their present Russian status that somehow they do not at the moment feel the need to opt for bhikkhuni ordination. And the saddest aspect of the bhikkhuni Burmese bhikkhu, Sachawati, was that eventually she did not get any support from her own nuns community at home, but was effectively excommunicated from it in 2004. Okay, so I think I have said what I wanted to say, and I am happy to have any questions. One more photograph. This is the last photograph of these nuns. As I said, the nuns and monks in Burma are quite complementary, and they do closely officiating rituals or preparing for rituals or on many religious occasions. They do interact, which may be a little bit different from other Buddhist countries. Here you can see that the monk has a lay assistant, Papya Karaka, who is supposed to receive all the cash donations on his behalf. The nuns are apparently, I think the nuns are giving the monk cash donations in an envelope, but is one of the interactions you see often in Burma. I find much more questions now. I think this is Rua's question. Are the Tadashi recognized as part of Sangha? So that is the interesting question. They are not... they are recognized as unofficial, or often the word that is used is they are recognized as relatives of the Sangha, or descendants of the Sangha. That is the term that is used in government documents, but not full members of the Sangha. On the other hand, as I said, it is quite ambiguous because compared to the situation in Thailand, they have a monastic passport, which is also when they get their legal passport to go abroad, they are recognized as monastic members. So in some contexts, they are given a monastic status legally. In another context, they are not recognized as full members of the Sangha. Do you think that it is possible that this part of a kind of structural violence? I heard monks who are against bhikshuni ordination saying our nuns are not interested. Due to this, it takes a lot of courage for the nuns to say the opposite, that they are interested. I don't know about this usage of the word structural violence, because I think the nuns, many of them really do not know about the bhikkhuni ordination issue, or that this has been going on in the international community. And Burma has been closed until 3 years ago, and of course they didn't have internet access and so on. So it is true that they are not familiar, or they are not, I would say not familiar rather than not interested. Probably if you put this across to the younger generation of nuns, which I have asked several of them, but they say, well, yes, they are interested. On the other hand, they say, we are already like the bhikkhuni. We are observing all the rules and regulations according to the National Code of Practice, which is very similar to the Patimokkha actually. And why do we have to go the extra mile, go to the international community, because we are already fulfilling our monastic duties, fulfilling our duties. But of course, as I said, Burma is in transition at the moment, a rapid transition, and the situation may change drastically. Kim Allen, is enlightenment acknowledged as an aspiration among them? Yes. I think to become enlightened, to become free from all the mundane sort of worries, to be free from all the kind of concerns you have in this world, to that kind of aspiration to become free from all that attachment is very, very strong, and also it is emphasized in their training as well. The next one is Aya Sudama. I have been told that the Burmese nuns are not allowed arms balls, and that a bhikkhuni who visited had to surrender her ball while there. Are there any? Well, of course, this is interesting, because traditionally, they did not go around with an arms ball, but they carried a tray on their head, and actually I had to practice many days to carry this tray on my head without dropping it, and I have dropped it on many occasions. Now, that custom, of course, it comes from the traditional custom of women carrying things on their heads in this part of Southeast Asia, and they find it much easier to carry on their heads, so that became the way to go out for alms. But nowadays, just like myself, the city girls cannot carry things on their head simply because they are out of practice. So now they are carrying these alms bowls around, which is much easier for them. And they have to, this is also the traditional custom, that they go out 2 days, two consecutive days before the full moon, the new moon, the hot moon. So I am surprised that Burmese nuns, do say Burmese nuns are not allowed alms, because they have to go on to alms. It is the monastic regulations sometimes have trouble trying to regulate the nuns who want to go out every day to collect alms. They are not allowed to go out every day, but on these two consecutive days, according to the lunar calendar. Champa Rodren, Svaraksa, considers this kind of structural violence to be cultural violence. Does this make more sense? I really object to using this kind of terminology so easily, because it does already impose a certain value before we can even start the discussion. This is not the perception. Well, you can go and talk to the nuns, but this is not the perception they have. And in a way, what do you mean by violence? Because I don't think they are experienced is that of a violence, but more about their priority would be more about maintaining an interdependent community, a harmonious coexistence, than thinking about a violent way of thinking imposed upon them. So, as I said, you know, I do not agree with any usage of this kind of English terminology imposed upon the actual reality, the religious life of these religious women. Okay, thank you.